news broke this morning of Permanent TSB's intention to buy out some of Ulster Bank's assets. To discuss this and the potential implications for customers of either institution, I'm joined on the line by Brendan Burgess, founder of AskAboutMoney.com. Brendan, you're very welcome to the programme. Let me see what's happening there. Brendan, can you hear us?
I can hear you clearly.
Great stuff. Brendan, I suppose the first point about this, which will impact customers of all banks across the country, is the further contraction and concentration of the Irish banking market.
Yes, we've a serious problem. Like we've had for the last 5 years, and it's something that I've been banging on about and nobody's really listening. Well, nobody in authority is listening. We've had the highest mortgage rates in the Eurozone for the last 5 years or more. And now we have a situation that the most expensive lender, Permanent TSB, is buying the mortgage book or a good section of the mortgage book from Ulster Bank, who is one of the cheapest lenders. And also at the same time, what's happening is KBC, which is the other cheapish lender, cheap, by the way, is comparatively cheap, is selling its mortgage book to Bank of Ireland. So we have the cheap, the lowest cost lenders leaving the country. We're going to be left with AIB, Bank of Ireland and Permanent TSB, who give cash back and who charge existing customers very, very high rates to pay for that cash back. And it's a very serious situation, and the government doesn't seem to give any care about it. The central bank doesn't care about it. And you know, the Competition and Consumer Protection Commission, I just haven't heard them doing anything about it either. I don't expect them to do anything about it. They've shown no interest in interest rates.
The Irish market, in banking terms, doesn't seem to be one that is readily attracting any new entrants at all. So whatever the status quo is once the dust has settled is likely to remain so for the years ahead, Brendan.
I think so. Now, we have had one very exciting new entrant, Avant Mortgages, who entered the market last year, and they are by far the cheapest lender for people who have low loan to value. So if you took out a mortgage, you know, if you bought a house 6-7 years ago and you probably took it out as an 80% or 90% mortgage, it's quite likely that with capital repayments and house prices increases in the meantime, your loan might well be 60% of the value of your house. So you should check out Avant Mortgages, because that's a very cheap loan. They have a rate which begin at 1.95%. You could be paying a rate with Permanent TSB, if you're a Permanent TSB customer, of, I think, their lowest, they've got rates of 3.9%. You know, a full 2%.
It's a huge difference.
Twice, yeah. So, and that's my main concern today. There are people who took out mortgages with Ulster Bank because Ulster Bank was a lower than the rest of them. They didn't card customers with cashbacks. And now they're going to be transferred to Permanent TSB, which pays for the cashbacks it gives to lure new customers by charging existing customers very high rates. For example, I gave an example there of a customer who has a mortgage of €300,000, could be paying a rate of 2.2% to Ulster Bank, and that could go up to 3.1% with Permanent TSB, which means over 20 years they would pay €30,000 more in interest than they would have paid to Ulster Bank.
And I'm not party to the minutiae of this deal, but surely people who are mortgage holders with Ulster Bank, whose mortgages are the subject, are part of this acquisition bundle, will have to be brought over on the terms and conditions of the mortgage that they signed up to.
That's absolutely correct. So if, for example, you're an Ulster Bank customer and you've got a tracker mortgage, you don't need to be in the least bit concerned. That tracker rate stays the same. If you're an Ulster Bank customer on a one-year fixed-rate mortgage of 3%, say, well then, Permanent TSB must respect that. But once the year is up, well then, your mortgage contract applies, and that says that the bank can offer you any rate that they wish. And as I say, the Permanent TSB rates are high. So this is what people should do. People who have Ulster Bank mortgages at the moment, who are not tracker mortgages, they should be looking to switch to a different lender now, either Avant or AIB. They would be probably the best value in the market. KBC is good value, but then they'd be gone to Bank of Ireland, so that doesn't solve that problem. They should be looking primarily at AIB or alternatively Avant. They're the two choices that we should look at. However, if maybe, you know, somebody has only 5 years left on their mortgage, or perhaps they're thinking, well, I'm going to be trading up in a couple of years' time, so why would I go to the expense of switching mortgages now and then find I'm going to have to get a new lender anyway in 2 years' time? Well, those people should get onto Ulster Bank now, and they should fix the mortgage rate for the remaining term that they expect to have a mortgage for. So if you have 5 years left on your mortgage, you know, it's probably not worth switching. So you can fix with Ulster Bank at a reasonably good rate, and Permanent TSB will have to recognise that. If you think you're going to trade up in 2 or 3 years' time, well, then maybe fix for 2 or 3 years. And something very important, you know, a lot of people have said on Ask About Money, oh, I'm in the middle of a three-year fixed rate. I fixed a year ago for 3 years, so I can't do anything for 2 years. That's not correct. If you want to switch, you can switch. You might have to pay an early repayment penalty for breaking out of a fixed rate early.
But depending upon your circumstances, I would imagine you could work out whether that's worth it.
Absolutely. But in a lot of situations, there's actually no early repayment penalty. So the first thing that an Ulster Bank customer should do, is who's in a fixed rate at the moment, is pick up the phone to Ulster Bank and say, how much would it cost me to break out of my fixed rate? And they might be pleasantly surprised. In nearly all cases, it makes sense to break out. That's probably too general to say that, but in a lot of cases, it makes sense to break out of the fixed rate and switch. That's if you're only fixing for, if you've only got a year or two left on the fixed rate.
Well, Brendan Burgess, founder of AskAboutMoney.com, thank you indeed for joining us there. Another part of the deal is the acquisition by PTSB of certain of Ulster Bank's business loans. 500 Ulster Bank employees will transfer to PTSB, along with 25 branches, of which two are here in County Kildare, in Kilcock and in Salbridge. Now, neither party revealed the bottom line cost of the deal, but we understand that it's in the region of 7.6 billion euro. Researchers at Trinity College Dublin have made an incredible breakthrough in the treatment of heretofore incurable childhood cancer, and they have done so by discovering how a specific genetic mutation operates. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Dr. Adrian Bracken. He's Associate Professor in Medical Molecular Genetics at Trinity College Dublin. Adrian, you're very welcome to the programme.
It's great to speak to you. Thank you.
Delighted to have you here. This is a really, really exciting breakthrough.
It is, yeah. I mean, our lab are very, very excited about it. It was published in Nature Genetics yesterday. And, you know, it creates some optimism and promise for what is truly a devastating disease. For about 5 to 10 families every year in Ireland, actually, in fact, 8 families, 8 children have been diagnosed with this particular disease so far. This year.
And you have traced it back to a specific genetic mutation called H3K27M, but what that does precisely is what, Adrian?
Yeah, so the just a little bit about the disease, and then I'll tell you the mutation. So the disease is a form of brain cancer, and it's incurable. It's so terrible that this is one of the few cancers that even the doctors are very, very upset when they see families coming in with children with this disease, because they know that they can perhaps extend the life expectancy of these children by a few months, but no more. So it's effectively not treatable. But a major breakthrough, we obviously had our paper yesterday, but probably the biggest paper prior to this was 2012, when they discovered this gene that you mentioned, this so-called cancer-causing gene, or oncogene, as you said, H3K27M. So what we did is studied the function of that, and as you asked, figured out how it's causing the cancer. And to sum up, what it's doing is it's causing normal brain cells to fail to mature, so to fail to become functional brain cells. And what they instead do is they continue to divide, continue to grow, and of course that's the cancer. And so by studying the genetics and biology of this particular cancer-causing gene, we're able to also, so we're understanding what it's doing, but importantly, that gives you an insight into what its weaknesses are. Mm. It's Achilles heel.
And it also gives a pipeline to treatment, perhaps not curative treatment, but life-prolonging treatment.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And that's probably a more realistic way to think about it, you know, because what we're talking about here is our paper, as you allude to there, it's suggesting a potential treatment option. So we found the weak point or the Achilles heel, and then we've suggested in the paper several drugs could work, and one in particular we found did work very, very well. And we're very confident that from a scientific perspective, this is the best drug that we can come up with so far because it directly targets the cancer-causing gene. But as your question alludes to there, of course, what needs to be done now are clinical trials. Mm. And as scientists, what we do is we pass on the baton now to clinical oncologists. And, you know, I suppose in the last year or two, we've all learned about clinical trials and they can be done quickly, but usually they're not, unfortunately. But we would hope that clinical trials will start in the next year. We're advocating for the trialing a particular drug called an EZH2 inhibitor.
And if clinical trials start as you expect, Adrian, within the next year, they might take 2 or 3 years to complete. So we could be looking at about 5 years before there is a prescribable medication.
That's true. A couple of extra information on that would be, firstly, the children that are on the clinical trial, should the drug be working, they're obviously immediately going to get benefit from it. So that's one thing. Mm. And then the other thing that perhaps might shorten the time frame slightly, but this particular drug has been already FDA approved. So the FDA is the US drug agency that, you know, approves drugs for treatments of various diseases, including cancers. And they approved this particular drug, the one I mentioned, this EZH2 inhibitor. They approved that in 2019 for treating two types of adult cancers. So what that effectively means is that we already know these drugs are tolerable in humans, albeit adults. So in terms of the safety of giving this particular drug, we know that it's not going to cause huge reactions. Of course, we'll have to try this in children and we'll see.
Well, it's certainly a very bright ray of hope. Dr. Adrian Bracken, Associate Professor in Medical Molecular Genetics at Trinity College Dublin and one of the key researchers in that breakthrough. Thank you indeed for joining us. There are 885,000 people on waiting lists at hospitals across Ireland for various forms of treatment. We're also seeing an increase in the number of people hospitalised for treatment for COVID-19, and there are going to be impacts for care right across the hospital sector. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Martin Varley. He's Secretary General of the Irish Hospital Consultants Association. Martin, you're welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Ciara.
This absolutely remarkable figure of 885,000 people on waiting lists for hospital appointments, that could be inpatient, it could be outpatient, it could be matters such as GI endoscopy. Whilst it is at a pinnacle now, we haven't had anything approaching what could be described as a normal waiting list in Ireland for many, many years.
No, we haven't, and it's unfortunate, and we've been highlighting this from hospital consultants and doctors' point of view. Our public hospitals are really overstretched because there's been a lack of investment in them for at least a decade. Of course, some of that can be pointed to as arising from the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, but we've lost ground in terms of investing in our capacity, in our space, in our beds, in our units. And in particular, we have the lowest number of consultants in the OECD, something like 40% below the average, not the best, the average. Mm. And likewise, we are equally below the average when it comes to acute hospital beds. So that creates a major bottleneck. And unfortunately, the public are suffering and the waiting lists are getting longer and longer. And this is true for hospitals which are relevant to your listeners, for example. In Nace General Hospital, there are over 10,000 people waiting for an outpatient appointment. In Tala, over 25,000. In St. James's, over 26,000. So altogether, those three hospitals, over 70,000 people waiting for an outpatient appointment with consultants. Now, our consultants and doctors see more vastly more patients in their clinics than internationally. Sometimes it's 2-3 times what an international clinic would see. So they're stretched, they're doing their best, and so are the hospitals, but the capacity just is not there. We're calling on the government to address the capacity, appoint more consultants, and in fact, fifth of our consultant posts are not filled as we speak on a permanent basis. We're not competitive internationally, and there are policy issues that have to be addressed in that regard.
Even in the absence of a pandemic, Martin, and that sounds like a strange thing to say when we're still in the middle of one, what was happening was we have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people whose day-to-day quality of life is profoundly negatively impacted by the duration of the time they are waiting for care. But also for you, your colleagues and healthcare professionals, under constant high levels of pressure. There's nobody benefiting here.
There's not, absolutely. And we're the first to acknowledge that the public and the people waiting, they have gone through an extremely challenging time because of COVID. But you have to allow on top of that, these are people waiting with medical conditions that should be seen and should be treated much more quickly. So that's piling pressure on top of pressure. And of course, the big concern we have and our consultants have, care delayed in some cases would be care denied, because if you don't treat people in an appropriate time frame, one is concerned they can deteriorate, unfortunately, and that's our big, big concern. We need timely care. We don't need anything like these waiting lists that have been growing and growing year after year over the last 5 years. Like, some of these waiting lists have doubled in the last 5 years for outpatient waiting lists. That's untenable. It's inappropriate. It makes it extremely difficult for the patients and the public. It makes it extremely difficult for the consultants and doctors treating them, because they would much prefer to treat people on time and get the solution and help people to get back on to work or whatever.
I would imagine complete resolution, or even inching towards a resolution of this situation, Martin, is something that we'll be looking at realistically in the medium to long term, because new consultants have to be trained or recruited from elsewhere. That is not a quick process. The money needs to be found to create additional capacity, and that additional capacity has to be delivered. Are there logistical or bureaucratic changes that could be made today which would improve the lot of some of those 885,000 people on that waiting list?
Well, those waiting, unfortunately, have to be outsourced, and that's a good thing from the point of view. It addresses some of the problem. In addition, there's insourcing, which means people work overtime and longer hours, but capacity in public hospitals to limit that on occasions. So a lot of that's been done. But of course, let's not forget, COVID has actually stymied our progress as well. It means some of the appointments which would have happened have been cancelled because of COVID developments, which actually take up hospital beds and ICU beds. Therefore, they limit how much you can do in a public hospital at any point in time. But other things that can be done, and some of this has been long-fingered for too long, and we've been saying it to our minister and others. Policies introduced back in 2012, effectively driving some of our highly trained specialists and consultants abroad. They are working in countries such as North America and Australia, New Zealand, etc. They will come back if some of those policy mistakes of the past were addressed. And we're actually trying to get negotiations on that as we speak with the Department of Health. Delays of any sort, even with regard to those administrative policy decisions, are not good for people. The more than delays on waiting lists are not good for people. So we have to actually engage and be solution driven, and not to ignore the reality. If something is driving people abroad that we need badly in our hospitals, we should actually address that without delay. Likewise, beds should be added, and some of that's been done in Tala recently, and more needs to be done in Tala, Nice and James. So we just need to have the government focused on addressing and fixing the health service problems and the hospital problems.
Do you get any sense, Martin, from your engagement on this and indeed other matters with the HSE and the Department of Health, that focus is very much there from their part?
We're starting to get there, I have to admit, and I also have to allow for the fact that everybody has been in a storm since March of 2020, reacting to most unpredictable events, and the cyber attack since May has been an additional challenge that was obviously coming at the worst of all times. We're not in the business of blaming anybody. We're in the business of actually trying to get solutions in place.
Well, Martin Varley, Secretary General of the Irish Hospital Consultants Association, thank you indeed for joining us. They're absolutely staggering figures, 885,000 patients on waiting lists for hospital appointments. That could include inpatient, outpatient, things like GI endoscopy, 10,000 of them at Nace General Hospital, 35,000 at Tallaght Hospital, which is, of course, a sister hospital of Nace in the Dublin Midlands Hospital Group. Forensic Science Ireland has released its annual report, and to take us through it, I'm joined on the line by Director General Chris Enright. Chris, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon.
First off, I would imagine when an awful lot of people hear Forensic Science Ireland, they imagine quite a lot of Gil Grissoms or Horatio Caines wandering around a building solving crimes. What is it that you do there?
Yeah, so our job in Forensic Science Ireland is to provide comprehensive scientific analysis, independent expert opinion, advice, training and research to support the Irish justice system, and to do that to the very best international standards. So we work on cases that range from murders, shootings, serious assaults, sexual assaults, drugs hauls and seizures and burglaries, and we've reported on over 22,000 cases over the past year, about 8,000 of which have been drugs-related offences. And while a lot of our work is very much laboratory-based, we do have a role to play throughout the criminal justice system, from crime scene to court. So on occasion, we go to crime scenes for things like blood pattern analysis. We then evaluate evidence back in the laboratory, do a lot of scientific analysis. And then we have to represent our conclusions in front of the courts and are subject to cross-examination. So a lot of work happens in the lab. It's, you know, we need to be incredibly patient around understanding the context and background to a case, extracting any meaningful evidence from an exhibit that comes into the laboratory, doing the scientific analysis, and then drawing conclusions from it.
It sounds like an incredibly diverse but complex workload, and very, very nuanced, not only in procedural terms but in practical terms.
It is. I mean, the starting point to work as a forensic scientist is a good degree and a good background in science, and we have people recruited from so many different scientific disciplines: physics, biology, genetics, chemistry, biochemistry. It covers the full spectrum, and there's a lot of extensive training that goes on when somebody actually joins Forensic Science Ireland. You need to be patient. You need to be good at critical thinking, really evaluating the information that's put in front of you so that you can make sound judgment and reasoning. You need to be a good communicator. You need to be able to represent your findings in a way that a jury can actually understand. Yeah, it's a complex role, but it's one that I know a lot of the staff find very, very fulfilling. You know, we have scientific staff, analytical staff. We also have IT professionals and administration professionals that really keep the show on the road as well. So we're blessed with having a very diverse, a very capable and a very committed workforce. So we're an essential service. So over the past 16 months, we've had uninterrupted services. We've kept the show on the road. And it's really down to the commitment and professionalism of the staff. It just wouldn't have happened without them.
And that show, and I use that term advisedly, Chris, as contained in your 2020 annual report, a significant increase in demand for the services and work of Forensic Science Ireland, due mainly to an increase in drug testing requests. So if anybody would hear a report of a drugs haul from on Garda Síochána, it would say XX amount of cocaine subject to analysis. You conduct the analysis.
That's correct. So if you look at over the last 2 years, there's actually been an increase of 74% in case submissions into Forensic Science Ireland. And it's really driven by three factors. One is drugs. Last year alone, there was an increase of 26%. But more significantly, 34% increase in complex cases. So we call a complex case something that relates to intent to supply or cultivation offence, so for example, a cannabis grow house. So that's increased by more than a third in a single year. And Garda Síochána are doing a tremendous job of Garda National Drugs and Organised Crime Bureau that you will hear. A lot of the big drug hauls and seizures around the country. There's also very active drug units around the country, and they've been very successful in detections at all levels. But that has a knock-on effect, and it's led to a really dramatic increase in demand for us that we're trying to catch up on.
You also manage the National DNA Database, which holds
Correct.
Close to 50,000 DNA profiles. How have they come to be collected?
Yeah, so as it stands today, it is over 54,000 actually at this point. It's moved on since the data in the annual report that was just published yesterday. But about 40,000 of those are profiles associated with specific known individuals. So they're suspects associated with crime or convicted offenders. You know, these could be an individual that's you know, a suspect for a particular offence. Their DNA sample is taken. Typically, it's a buccal swab that's taken from the mouth that's submitted into us and then analysed and added onto the DNA database. There's pretty stringent and very, very clear legislation on the grounds for taking a DNA sample, how it's processed, how it's managed, and if and when it should be deleted. What we also have then is a crime, what we call a crime scene index. So we have an exhibit from a particular crime. It could be, for example, a balaclava that's discovered at an armed assault or a murder scene. That could be submitted to us, and we have to evaluate it and see, is there any evidence we can actually glean from this? Can there be DNA from the underside of the balaclava, for example? Whether there is or is not a suspect, that's extremely valuable information. So we get that a DNA profile uploaded to the database, and there could be a match that we'd learn about immediately against a suspect or a convicted offender for a previous crime. Or it would remain there until a particular suspect is identified, and we could do a match comparison at that point.
The DNA database has also helped to bring closure to the families of nine missing people, in that you were able to positively confirm the identity of their remains.
Yes, and this is something that's really moved on in leaps and bounds over the last number of years. There was a lot of hard work put in place here by my predecessors over many, many years. This didn't happen overnight. It was long and steady investment in forensic science has led us to the point where we can do more now. There's really good work done in bone recovery, how to get more and more usable DNA from degraded bones. In some cases, we see, you know, bone samples might be heavily degraded from being in the water and salt water for a period of time. So the technology to extract usable DNA from those has come on considerably. We're using more and more sensitive DNA techniques now. We also have the benefit of the DNA database, and we also have software that allows us to compare unknown human remains with family members. It's you need to do a stringent statistical comparison before you can actually declare with any degree of confidence that this is a positive identification. And as you say, there was nine missing persons that we were able to assist with. There's a missing persons bureau within An Garda Síochána, and we work very closely with them to see where science and technology can help bring closure to those families. So it's an area that we continue to push and do more and more.
Well, Chris Enright, Director General of Forensic Science Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us this afternoon.